Hello and welcome to Thinking Poker Podcast. This is episode 17?
18.
18. I really have to either look this up before we start or...
Maybe I should just start doing the intro a little bit more often. How's it going, Andrew?
I'm good. We got a big show today, a big guest. Isaac Caxton.
Yes.
Ike.
Yes.
From 2 Plus 2, newest member of PokerStars Team Online, and a pretty interesting guy once you get him going.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he's very near the top of the game, and he's done a lot of interesting things, been a lot of interesting
places.
He is
the top of the game.
Okay. I would trust you to know that more than
I mean, really, I think, I mean, I know he mentioned there's kind of a handful of people that he won't play heads up at No Limit Hold'em, but I mean, I think handful is probably literally correct, like countable on one hand. I mean, I think when it comes to heads up No Limit, he's about as good as it gets.
Yeah, it's awesome. And so hopefully we can get some strategy from him. And certainly we're grateful that he's coming on the show. So we have a mailbag segment today. Do you want to get into that?
Yeah.
All right. So we got a couple emails about the cheating segment from last week. And the first one today, we're going to talk about one, then we're going to talk about some of the next email. The first one comes from Jason, who says, "Honestly, I think Nate was nearly 100% off base about what he described as cheating. Dealer ineptitude, rolling cards, is just that, ineptitude, not necessarily cheating. It falls into the category of rules enforcement, like players talking about the hand while in progress, much more dangerous, or people showing their neighbor cards before mucking. Is it right? No. Is it cheating? No. Dealers palming chips from the pot has been rumored at a few places I play, but frankly, unless I'm in a really big game, what am I risking? Anyway, that's not cheating in the Webster Dictionary sense of the word, that is theft. And you've discussed theft in your podcast before, in terms of protecting yourself from things like being mugged in a parking lot, etc. To me, real loss, I define that as a buy-in or full stack, not three red birds over a year, from cheating is more likely from active trickery, pesky Webster's again, at the table that would come from acts like collusion, card marking, or serious angle shooting." Okay, interesting email. Thanks for writing in. I've got a few things to say about that. The first is that is just a semantic point. In the poker world, if a dealer is doing things that he's not supposed to do and doing that in order to steal chips, that is a cheating dealer. And that's
or to enable someone else to steal.
Yes. So if somebody's rolling the deck and exposing the card to the one seat intentionally, if somebody's shuffling the pot and palming a chip, if somebody's, you know, making change in a funny way and putting a $5 chip into his tip box, that's a cheating dealer. And yes, what he's cheating to do is steal, but that's just what cheating dealer means. Second, I definitely agree, and a few people have told me this, that many dealers are obviously just bad and not stealing. But I would bet that at least some of them are stealing. So what I said is that there is nobody who I think is stealing. That is not to say that I think that nobody is stealing. It's a very important difference. Everybody that I chat to, I wouldn't say that there are many, but if you ask me if at least one dealer at a card room in America is stealing from players right now, I would happily bet some money on yes.
Yeah, I think we probably could have made more clear in that segment, because I mean, we kind of introduced it as this is going to be about cheating and stealing, and then we talked some about just general mistakes that dealers make that are potentially not exactly well-intentioned, because I think they're not intentioned at all, but that aren't badly intentioned. And I don't know how clearly we ever drew the connection between the two. But part of the problem is that when you have dealers who aren't properly trained, they're enabling cheating to take place, even if they aren't cheating themselves. Like, one, they're not trained to spot it, and two, they may be doing things like rolling the deck that enable players to get an unfair advantage, even if it's not something they're doing deliberately. So because we're talking about cheating and dealers, wouldn't necessarily, I mean, in some cases we are talking about cheating dealers, in other ways we're talking about dealers who are unwittingly enabling cheating.
Yeah, actually, I think the most important point is even a third thing, which is that it erodes the general procedures of security that we need to be able to play the game. So yeah. Let's say I were a card cheat. I would love the idea of getting employed as a poker dealer because I could walk in, pass some interviews. I mean, not that it's easy to get a job, but if the job opening somehow presented itself, that would be great if I had bad intentions because the procedures are not being enforced and I can put my hands in the pot and do all sorts of things and deal the river card by actually rotating the deck 180 degrees and sliding off the top card with the thumb of the hand that's holding the deck. It's, I don't like that. How about that? Right. So I think the bigger risk is that poker is a game played with a lot of money, and where there's money, people want to steal it. And to keep people from stealing money, you need strong, consistent security procedures. And having people who aren't following the procedures erodes those in a lot of ways and will keep us from being able to play the game.
And it also makes it, I mean, because you can make this point and say, like, oh, well, a lot of dealers are just lazy or lax about security or poorly trained or something. And that's true. You know, I think there are a lot of dealers who are rolling the deck and nothing bad is coming of it, and or the dealer is not intending anything bad. But at the same time, that makes it harder to catch the one who is, because it's no longer just a dealer who rolls the deck is cheating. Yes. Now there are thousands of dealers who roll the deck, and 99% of them aren't cheating, but no one says anything about it because it's so common, and therefore it enables that 1% who are to get away with it.
Yes, an analogy would be losing the technology of the cash register. I mean, if you think about it, it's really good that people are able to hire any random 16-year-old kid to staff a convenience store or something. And one reason that they can do that is that although most of them are not thieves, having a cash register makes it really hard for them to steal, at least in certain ways. And it would be a bad thing for everybody, the consumer, the proprietor, all these people, if we couldn't have technologies like the cash register. And what's going on in poker right now, I think, is something like, in many places, losing the technology of the cash register.
Yeah.
So, right, I have two more things to say about Jason's email. A third one is that I think he's just wrong on the cost of dealer cheating. A cheating dealer could fill up a tip box with red every day, and in fact, that's how they're sometimes discovered, because they're just making so much money. And guess who that money's coming from?
Even if it's not all coming from you, it is all coming out of the, I mean, that, like, it may be true that a single player cheating at your table is taking more money from you personally, and, you know, he is maybe only cheating for 2 or 3 hours in a day, maybe. Yeah. Versus a dealer is who might be stealing smaller amounts over the course of weeks or years that he's doing this. In the end, the dealer is going to end up being the one taking more money. It may be more widely distributed, but I don't think that means that less is coming from you, because the likelihood of that person taking something from you is higher, even though the amount he's taking is lower than you know, it's kind of like a bad beat if you end up at the table with the one cheating player who ends up taking a whole stack from you. But you know, probabilistically, it's more likely that cheating dealer is going to, his expected value from you is higher.
Yeah. Count up the amount of money you pay in rake every year. A cheating dealer would probably take an amount of money equal to, I don't know, 25%, 30% of the rake, and ask yourself if that's something you want to suffer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the last thing is that something that a few people said is, why worry about floor and dealer behavior instead of player behavior? And this actually gets into our next email from Matt. It's a really good email. It's long, and it's actually better than I will represent here, just because it's too long to discuss right now, and it raises a whole bunch of other issues that we want to talk about on a future episode. But this last concern is, why be worried about the house and not the other players? And the easiest answer here is twofold. First, that correct dealer procedure and correct floor procedure encourages and enforces correct player procedure. So I would rather not even make the dichotomy. I've definitely been in games with players who were doing things I was uncomfortable with, where the floor just refused to do anything about it. In fact, that's one reason that the guy I mentioned last week, the floor person who dislikes me so much, because I was getting on his case about these things once. And second, you can protect yourself from a cheating player or a dishonest player more generally a lot easier than you can protect yourself from a dishonest dealer. If somebody's going to angle shoot you, you usually have defenses. If somebody's going to try to short the pot, you usually have defenses. And if somebody's going to, you know, try to, even collusion, you often can detect. And frankly, in Hold'em, collusion is a lot less of a problem than it is in some other games, like, say, Limit Omaha 8 or better. So you have more recourses against, you can do more by your own agency to stop cheating players than you can to stop cheating dealers. If you're playing in a rebuy tournament in a local casino and rebuys are $100 and they're collected by hand, and then just at the end of the rebuy period, it's announced how big the prize pool is, good luck verifying that for yourself. And and that's actually one scenario where floor people have sometimes been discovered taking money for themselves. So you can do more to protect yourself. But notice that the things you can do to protect yourself against other players often involve recourse to the administration of the card room, which is why the ladder is just so necessary for the game to exist the way it is.
Yeah, and it's also why, you know, I hinted at this a little bit in the previous episode, what I was asking about, should players be concerned about, like, alienating floor people? And I was kind of saying it as though, like, your relationship with the floor person is a positive thing, which it can be, or with the dealers for that matter.
Yes.
But I do think there are also, there's maybe even more circumstances where the relationship between players and staff is, at least in small ways, a bad thing, where when an issue about a player is reported, and that's a player who is known to tip well in the room and is, like, kind of generally widely liked in the room, I don't have any evidence of this, but it's a strong concern of mine that I feel like that issue is going to be taken less seriously, or less is going to be done about it than if something is reported about a player who doesn't have that sort of glad-handing relationship with the staff of the room. And then, of course, there's a number of other ways in which the, you know, players can be helped, just by jumping spots in the wait list, or getting seats in particularly good games, getting players moved to their tables. I guess that maybe there's some dispute in the poker world as to whether these are just legitimate benefits that, you know, people are entitled to buy, or whether they're unfair. But I think it's clear where I stand on that issue.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, there are some borderline cases about which benefits are permissible or not. But I think the one thing that's really clear is that you want to be one of those people who has a good relationship with the staff, in part so that you can discuss these issues with them in a friendly way, so that it doesn't look like you're some crazy person or some complete nit just raging, just so you can bring things up in a calm way and say, hey, I'm a little bit worried about these two people. I'm a little bit worried about this situation. One thing that happened to me once, I was in a card room where I'd never been before, except a couple times, but thankfully I'd managed to have a nice chat with one of the floor people. And I bought into a 2-5 game with, among other things, a small stack of green chips, 4 green chips. And after 2 hours, I noticed that although I had not lost any pots where I'd put the green chips in, I only had 2 green chips. And that was strange. And so, you know, I found a spot to, you know, just sort of quietly corner a floor person and say, hey, you know, I'm not sure, it could have been a lot of things, but I didn't lose those 2 green chips playing poker, and I did lose 2 green chips, so what's going on? And he, you know, he said, okay, you know, and he was respectful about it. He looked around for a second. He said, you do know there are 2 green chips in the rack, right? And they'd just been, the dealer changed them out of the pot without me noticing during the pots that I played with them. So, I mean, I felt a bit sheepish, but I mean, it was fine. I mean, the floor didn't resent me for it. I didn't resent anybody else for anything that had happened, and everything went on fine. And this is a place where I still have good relations with the staff. So it's just a good story about how you want to be the sort of person who can raise issues in a gentle way, then you often get better results. And of course, usually there's nothing nefarious going on. So.
Right. But that's the culture that ought to exist. And I feel like doesn't exist in a lot of card rooms, or maybe it's just because I'm not a player who's known in those card rooms in the same way that regulars are. But I feel like the culture ought to be one where even though there's a good chance nothing is going on, players feel perfectly comfortable saying, you know, can we just make sure that everything is okay? And the floor accepts that as just, you know, of course we can. It's in everyone's interest to make sure that the game is secure and they can look into it and then, you know, provide a reasonable explanation of what happened and everyone can walk away satisfied. Not that I have a lot of direct experience with this, but the sense I get is that that's not often the way that that it goes down, and probably a lot of the responsibility for that is on the players for not raising issues in the most respectful way. But I think also there's probably a lot of staff who bristle in expectation even when a player is raising something in an appropriate and non-accusatory way, who are kind of bracing because of previous experiences they've had with players.
Yeah, I think that's right. So thanks to Jason and Matt for writing in. Or Jason and the one-fifth of Matt's email that we discussed. And we'll discuss some of these other issues about protecting yourself against cheating players in some future episode. But thanks, and I think we should talk about a strategy hand now.
So this one comes in. This is actually just a student of mine who sent this hand to me by email, not specifically for use on the podcast, but I think he'll be okay with our discussing it. Yeah. But I'm not going to use any names for that reason. So this is a hand that's submitted by an acquaintance of mine. This is from a $150 tournament today. It was a relatively small field. I don't know exactly what the field was, but first place paid $2,000, so to give you an idea of approximately how many people might have been in the tournament. So this player says that he felt he was clearly one of the best players in the field. He ended up chopping the tournament when there were four people remaining, but this is a hand that occurred when there were four tables remaining. He said that the average stack was $15,000 and that he had $45,000. The blinds were 200, 400. He doesn't mention it, but I'm pretty sure there would be an ante by this point, so probably 200, 450.
Yes.
And a strong player opened in early position to 1,200, and he had a 25K stack. So he's making a 3X raise under the gun out of a 25K stack.
Okay.
Our hero is in middle position, holding ace-king suited. The hand gets a little more complicated, but just to start here, what are your thoughts on 3-betting versus calling with ace-king suited here?
You know, it sounds strange, but I actually just call frequently in this spot just because, especially a live player's under the gun range, especially in a tournament, is going to be pretty tight. I like to, you know, especially with a hand like ace-king suited that plays a little bit better if six people call behind you, then that's great. You keep dominated hands in his range. You disguise the strength of your hand a little bit. I just don't do a whole lot of 3-betting of under the gun raises from early middle position or earlier in these live tournaments. And I mean, it depends on a lot of particulars. If I think that he's even a little bit laggy, then of course there are some obvious reasons to 3-bet. The really obvious thing to say is don't 3-bet if 4-betting will be a terrible thing to happen to you.
Yeah.
But I certainly don't dislike flat calling. What do you think?
I think there's the last point you made is perhaps the most important. That here, I think that you don't really want to put 25K in, even though it's like fewer than 60 big blinds and you have ace king. It is. It's a live tournament where people's ranges tend to be tighter. It's an under the gun raise. It's a 3X raise, which I think even knowing nothing else about this player, I think you can often deduce what people's ranges are going to be. Like people who have tighter opening ranges tend to have larger raise sizes for good reason.
Yes.
And people who are min raising or just barely more than min raising are more likely to be the type who are opening a ton of hands. So again, like if this was just my very first hand against this player, I knew nothing about him, probably I would 3-bet if he had made a small raise, and I would just call if he was 3xing or more. And the reasons for that are primarily that it has to do with how I'm going to feel about getting 4-bet. Like if I'm 4-bet by a very loose, aggressive player, I'll be more comfortable 5-betting all in. I certainly won't be happy if he calls the 5-bet, but I think ace-king will be a good enough 5-betting hand to be worth making that play. Or an okay hand even for flatting the 4-bet, depending on the size of it. And I also think that he'll be willing to call the three bet with hands that ace king dominates. And that's a real key point, is that when you have ace king, especially if you don't think it's all that profitable, even if it's slightly profitable to get it in preflop, it may not be the most profitable option available to you. I mean, here this the hero is saying he thinks he's one of the best players in the field, which I think is probably true. And he has position as well. So there's a lot that can go well for him if they play this out post-flop. So if he's going to have even a very small edge, getting it all, just like three betting and getting it all in pre-flop, I still think that he may be better off playing it out after the flop when his potential edge is larger, where he can leverage his position and his superior skill to make better decisions than his opponent. And one of the best scenarios for that, when you have a hand like ace-king, of course, you'd really like your opponent to have ace-queen, ace-jack, king-queen, king-jack, the kinds of hands that, although it won't happen often, it'll happen about as often as you flop a set. It's nearly as profitable as flopping a set, which is you get to the spot where you have a top pair top kicker and your opponent has top pair second kicker. Mm-hmm. And that's a very profitable spot to be in, and that has potential to win a big pot and to get money in the pot as a much bigger favorite than I think you would if you just ended up getting all in pre-flop. And I know we're only looking at a 1200 raise, but I do think that you have to be thinking about the possibility of getting all in pre-flop. That's why I keep coming back to that point, because once you three bet, I don't think you want to three bet and fold to a four bet. So I wouldn't three bet against someone where I felt like I was going to have to fold to a four bet.
Yeah. I mean, if you should be thinking about the stack size pretty much all the time that you're playing a no limit poker game. So hooray for that. So yeah, I do think my sense is, and this is just sort of raw instinct, is that the exact stack size matters a bit here. I would feel better about getting it all in if the effective stack were even something like 18K. Is,
yeah, 18 was about the cutoff I was going to give to.
All right, very good.
I don't have a real clear reason for that, but 18 was the number that felt right to me.
All right. So what happens next?
So hero flat calls with the ace king suited, which Nate and I are agreeing is a pretty defensible play. And then he says there's a short stack who shoves for 6K.
Okay.
So we've got an under the gun raise to 1200, a call, and then this guy is shoving in for 6K. On the one hand, he has 15 big blinds. On the other hand, again, it's a live tournament. People's ranges do tend to be a little tighter in these things, and I don't think he has any expectation of making both players fold. I think when he shoves the 6K here, I think he is probably expecting he's going to be called by at least one person, right? We've got an under-the-gun raise and a call. It's pretty unlikely anyone is folding. They're going to be getting close to 2-1 at this point. I think it's pretty unlikely either that both of these players will fold to his shove. So I think that his and a lot of players also just don't understand why, even if like he's able to make one of these players fold and he can raise heads up against the other one with a nice overlay. I mean, there are some reasons why really skilled players might have a slightly wider shoving range here, yeah, with the expectation that they can get a heads up with someone. But I don't necessarily expect to see that logic. Like, I think a lot of people, a lot of more amateurish live tournament players are going to have a much tighter range here than your typical and certainly than your very good professional, and especially professional online tournament player, is going to have for sticking in the 6K.
I think it's right that a lot of people will, but I also think that a significant number of people will just be losing their minds here and either losing their discipline, or they'll be angry about whatever hand it was that brought them down to 6K, or they'll just have an indistinct idea that when your stack remaining is five times the size of the opening raise, that it's a good spot to ship it all in. So I'm not saying that there will be really good articulated reasons for this, but you really will just see queen eight, queen nine, ace six, king 10, not from every player and maybe not even from a lot of players, but the fraction of players who will do that make a big difference to the equity that you have against the range with which they're doing that. So,
yeah, that's a fair point. I think I do have a tendency to put people in too tight ranges in some of the hands that we've discussed on the show.
Yeah, that's right. So there are some good reasons to think that his range will be tighter than the average person's range for putting in 15 big blinds. But I would also just say that you can't overthink this, and especially live players. And there's like a social aspect to this. Like, he's looking around the table. That guy has 45. That guy has 25. That guy has 35. I have 6. And people just lose their minds, and you've got to just you've got to account for that. So you just can't be too worried about the 6K.
So we've got this guy shipping for 6K, and then under the gun, the action folds back to the original Razor who was under the gun, and he shoves over the top for 25K.
Yeah.
So now it's back to Hero, who's going to be calling like 24K more into a pot that's now, I guess, close to 35K in the pot. So Hero is going to be, that's like 24 into 36, roughly.
Yeah.
So 3 to 5?
Yes.
Okay, so one thing is that I think it's probably plus Chippy V to call here. I think it's definitely plus Chippy V to call here, yes. Meaning that if this were a cash game and not a tournament, or it were a rebuy tournament or something else where the you didn't have the tournament EV effect or the variance between your chip EV and your dollar EV the way you have in a tournament, where the worth of your, whether or not a play will have a positive expectation in chips, necessarily translates into a positive expectation of money. If you subtract that aspect of the hand for a moment, I think this is clearly a call that you want to make.
Yeah.
The only reason that I think it's worth discussing is because it's a relatively large pot in a tournament. I mean, it's a pot that's the amount of money in the pot even before Hero calls is more than twice the average stack, and the amount Hero has to risk is more than the average stack at this point in the tournament. So there's some question as to if Hero believes that he is the strongest player in the tournament, is this a bad spot for him to gamble?
I mean, I think that there's definitely something to be said for that, but there's a very important point, which is that if you lose, you're not out. In fact, if you lose, you still have 20K. So if you're that good at accumulating chips, most of the things that you do that let you accumulate chips are things that you can do perfectly well with 50 big blinds. I know, and maybe this is excessively personal, but the things that I do that I think make me better than average at accumulating chips in a tournament is finding the best spots to blind steal, the best spots not to blind steal, the best spots to call 2.5 big blind raises and then take it down on the flop, and the best spots to make a 3-bet pre-flop expecting to take it down. And 50 big blinds is more than enough to do all those things. So you can accumulate just fine if you lose this pot. I would also say a sort of analogous point about just your equity in this spot, which is that just as a certain fraction of people will be very tight from the small blind in the spot, but some of them definitely won't, although some people will only shove in over the top for 25K with a very tight range, you really have to be worried about the fraction of people who are shoving in the original Razor spot with anything that they're not folding with. And there are some good reasons to do that. So,
yeah, like to drive you out of the pot with hands like, I mean, maybe as good as Ace King, but certainly Hero could have sort of medium pocket pairs, Ace Queen.
Yeah.
Hands that, I mean, like if Hero has Ace Queen, I probably would say he should fold here. Not probably, I would say he definitely should fold here.
Yeah.
If he has pocket eights, I think this is a fold. So, I think that there's good reasons why Under the Gun might shove with hands, you know, like
Ace Queen.
Pocket. Like Ace Queen or pocket nines, looking to drive Hero out of the pot and just to have a, you know, race against the short stack in a relatively large pot with some nice overlay.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if the story had ended where Hero said, "I called," and the other two guys had Ace Queen under the gun and Queen seven from the small blind, like I'd be a little bit surprised, but not very. And I certainly wouldn't be surprised if it was sixes and fives or Ace Queen and Ace Queen or Ace Queen and Ace Jack or a hand like that. So,
yeah. And so I, for one thing, I would be a lot more inclined to consider folding if, as you're saying, this was the last of Hero's chips. If Hero also only had 25K, such that losing the pot here would mean losing, or Hero only had 30K, such that losing the pot here would kind of handcuff Hero to the point where his only options were to shove or fold pre-flop, and he'd be losing a lot of the edge that his skill was giving him because he wouldn't really have the room to exercise that skill.
Yeah.
I'm still not saying I would necessarily fold, but I would at least be more willing to entertain folding. But yeah. As you say, you know, in this case, Hero can call lose the pot and still have more than an average stack. So I think that this is actually a case where you don't have to be particularly risk averse, despite the fact that it's a tournament, because it's not really threatening even close to the last of your chips. And that's the main reason why you'd be risk averse in a tournament. And we're also still pretty far away from, I don't know what the money bubble was, but pretty far away from the final table with four tables to go. So it's going to be some time before the really big effects of chip EV versus dollar EV start to come into play, which is like at the final table, there's become more and more room to make nitty folds sometimes for ICM reasons, but I don't think we're that close to that point yet.
I think that's right. And, another thing that I could imagine you saying, I could imagine myself having hired you as a coach and brought this hand to you and said, "But Andrew, I'm so good at accumulating. Should I really be doing this?" And I could imagine you saying something to me like the way you sometimes say, "Okay, you want to be in position. How will you use your position? How are you going to accumulate?" I mean, it really does make a difference. The way I accumulate chips, being left with 50 big blinds, is no big deal, and I'm happy with that. If I were Galen Hall, that would be something different. He likes to run a lot of big bluffs. I mean, if you are Vanessa Selbst, then a lot of the amazing things that you're doing to accumulate chips are really things that you can do better with 100 big blinds instead of 50. Of course, if you're Vanessa Selbst, you're probably not asking me for poker advice,
You're
but
also
it
probably
really,
not folding ace king preflop too often.
yeah, probably not. Yeah, and people are probably playing against you very differently than they're playing against the hero. But the point is, you always want to look farther into these reasons that you give. If you want to preserve your stack, ask yourself why. If you want to be in a position, ask yourself why. How, and so it depends a bit on your playing style. What is it that you do that makes you a better player and that will let you accumulate chips? And I think that'll determine a lot of your answer. And if you're like most players, I think the 50 big blinds is more than
So, thanks for submitting the hand, anonymous student.
enough.
Hopefully, this was more helpful to you than the short email you otherwise would have gotten in response from me that I'll probably send you anyway. And yeah, thanks for an interesting discussion.
So good. Little bit shorter strategy talk this time, but I think that's fine. And I think we
And
can,
maybe we'll try to talk a touch of strategy with Ike as well.
yeah, hopefully. And we should go get him. How about that?
All right.
How's it going?
Heck.
Good. Very good.
So randomly, I was just watching you on PokerStars TV yesterday because my wife and I have been watching the 25K high roller from last year, and
Okay, cool.
you were playing with a lot of confidence on television, and obviously you've played for a lot of money before, and so you aren't going to be nervous for that reason. But like for example, you called a preflop raise with from Jason with ace 10 offsuit, and you flopped a 10, came like king 10 X, and you folded to one bet on the flop. And whatever you want to say about that play, it shows a lot of confidence, right? You obviously weren't worried about looking silly on television. Like, was it hard to not modify your play to being on TV?
Not particularly. I feel like even before I was used to it, that's a circumstance I've excelled in. I tend to play better and focus better the more pressure there is, and I can sort of tune out the fact that it's going to be on TV later and not worry so much about looking dumb. And yeah, I just think I step it up in those sorts of circumstances.
Because you are, I mean, most of your background really is online poker. I mean, especially for other people, I think of as being in your echelon in terms of the stakes that you play. It seems like you're more oriented towards online poker than almost anyone, except maybe like the Dang Brothers.
I mostly play online. I don't know. I've played at least a couple hundred live tournaments.
But I mean, it seems like you have a pretty strong preference for online poker. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the basis of that?
I mean, I think my hourly rate's a lot better playing online, first and foremost, with the exception of the very biggest and best live tournaments. I think I'm mostly better served staying home and playing online, but I also think it's more fun. My favorite sort of poker to play, just from an entertainment perspective, is definitely Heads Up No Limit.
Right, which I guess is
And
pretty hard to find in life.
yeah, you can't really play live. I mean, even if you could get a game, you're still playing 25, 30 hands an hour. It's just nowhere near as fun as playing a couple tables against somebody online.
And you don't have trouble getting action online?
I do and I don't. There's a relatively small list of people who will play me, but they are people who are online every day, and I can get a lot of hands in against the rotating group of five or so people who want to play Cash Heads Up No Limit with me. And
do you worry they're going to quit you?
Yeah. I also play a lot of Heads Up Sit and Goes when I can't get cash action, and there doesn't seem to be any shortage of Heads Up Sit and Go action.
Yeah, I guess that people can't really quit, because once they open sit, then they have to play whoever sits down against them, right?
Right, and it doesn't seem like people are willing to just let me have all of the lobbies.
Yeah.
So you sit down first and let people join you? You don't try to do much game selection and only wait to see who your opponent is before you join?
I don't game select all that much. There are only a handful of Heads Up Sit and Go guys I'm not pretty excited to play against. At Hyper Turbos, I think Skywalker is really tough. At, you know, regular turbos, I'm willing to play anybody.
And you think that's just because they know that specific format of, I guess it's mostly a shove fold game in the hypers. You feel like they just know that format better than you do?
Yeah. Yeah. I have a pretty high opinion of my own game in the hypers, but I haven't done that well. Mm-hmm. So there's a pretty strong chance that they know something I don't.
Right. Is that something that you've put a lot of work into studying, or is your study effort more oriented towards your heads-up cash play?
In the last year, I've been putting more effort into the heads-up sit-and-goes also. I got Supernova Elite playing heads-up sit-and-goes mostly last year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I played maybe an equal number of hours of heads-up cash, but you get the VPPs maybe 10 times as fast in the sit-and-goes, somewhere in that vicinity.
Is this the first time where you've had a high opinion of your game, but your results haven't followed, and you've had to conclude that maybe your game isn't where you thought it was? Or have I mischaracterized the situation?
No, you're not mischaracterizing the situation, but I wouldn't say it's the first time either. I think at various points my game has either gotten out of whack or out of tune with how other people are playing in a bunch of different places. I think I spent a year playing a lot of live tournaments very poorly.
Like what sorts of things? I mean, one thing people say a lot is impatience. Is, do you think you were doing that, or do you think you were missing spots that only come up live that you don't get online, or what sorts of things were you doing badly, do you think?
In my first year playing live tournaments, I finished second in the PCA in like the second major live tournament I'd ever played, and then just went and played all the big live tournaments I could find, and I just wasn't that good at tournaments yet. I wasn't actually impatient, but it probably looked like I was to somebody who had a good idea what they were doing, because I was doing it in bad a lot. it wasn't a matter of impatience. It was just a matter of thinking I should get in a lot lighter than I should.
And that's specific to live play, just because you feel like live tournaments are nittier than usual? Or why do you think you were overestimating how light you should get it in?
I was just bad at tournaments altogether at that point. I had switched from – I started out as a Limit Hold'em player. I played nothing but Limit Hold'em 2004, 5, and 6. And then in late 06, I started playing No Limit and still rarely tournaments, mostly just cash games. Mm-hmm. And just played the PCA sort of on a whim. I won a satellite and went down and finished second.
Yeah.
And – decided I was good at tournaments and went and played a lot of them, and I just wasn't.
Why did you stick with Limit Hold'em for so long?
When I started playing in 2004, it was where the best action seemed to be. Mm-hmm. With the exception of some very high stakes No Limit games that ran occasionally on smaller networks, you know, those famous games with like Prahlad and Taylor Cabey and Durr on UB or...
And very high stakes at that time is like 2550?
2550 through 100, 200. 100, 200 No Limit was running every once in a while in 2004, 2005.
Okay.
But I mean, I was playing real small at that point, but I was just sort of looking at what games were out there, and I thought, if I'm going to be a professional poker player, my goal should be to like beat 1530 Limit Hold'em. 1530 Limit Hold'em was a pretty big game that you could reliably 8 table back in 2004, 2005. So that was what I focused on. And I mean, I knew a couple people who were competent Limit Hold'em players at that point too. So I had some people to talk strategy with. I posted a lot on the 2+2 high stakes limit hold'em forum, which was awesome relative to the state of knowledge in that game at that time.
So that was your aspiration. Like when you came in, you started playing poker with an eye towards being a professional immediately?
I started playing online, yeah, with an eye towards doing it at least seriously part-time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were you working before that, or was that kind of like your first job?
I worked one summer in my friend's father's spring factory between my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college.
Like pet springs?
All kinds of springs.
How many kinds of springs are there?
Thousands. But they did custom orders as well. I mean, you don't think about it, but there are springs in everything you own.
Yeah.
The thing that's used to make everything you own has springs in it, and all of the things you own have springs in them too.
So do you still know how to make a lot of springs, or were you doing other things at the...
I never knew how to make springs. My job was that they had decided that the end of the factory that was currently the loading dock should be the warehouse, and the end of the factory that was currently the warehouse should be the loading dock. And me and my friend had to take apart the warehouse, carry everything to the other end of the factory, and put it back together.
There are worse ways to spend a summer.
It wasn't so bad, but I was pretty determined not to have a similar job afterwards by the time I was done.
Are you willing to reveal what you got paid for the work at the Spring Factory? If you aren't,
I don't remember exactly. I think it was in the vicinity of $7 an hour.
Right. Yeah, you could do worse.
Yeah.
What else were you doing at that time? You were into Magic the Gathering as well?
Yeah, I played Magic pretty seriously through high school. Started playing when I was younger than that, but was just sort of goofing around. Like when I was 10 years old, basically just making up the rules that went. Mm-hmm. And then stopped playing for a few years, came back to it when I was like 14 and started, you know, traveling to tournaments and playing competitively.
Mm-hmm. Have you always been really into games, like even before Magic?
Yeah, definitely. I started playing chess when I was 4. I started playing it pretty seriously in tournaments when I was 6.
Wow.
And yeah, with maybe a little break between like 11 and 14 where I played more sports and less games, I've been really serious about one game or another at all points in my life.
Is poker the game you love most, or is there, or do you just play poker because that's where the money is?
I really enjoy poker. I'd say Magic is competitive with it for which is the most fun. I got sick of chess eventually.
Too much memorization, or just didn't fit your style, or what?
Yeah, too much memorization. Honestly, the luck component to the other games makes them a lot more fun. I mean, I reached this point in my chess career where I was, like, really solidly the second best player in my county.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just go to tournaments, and I would beat everybody except the kid who was better than me, and he would beat me. It got to feel like, why am I even showing up? I'm just going to go and beat these guys who don't have a chance, and I'm going to play the kid who's better than me, and I'm not going to have a chance.
It's useful for poker because a lot of poker players never realize that the luck is really essential to keeping people playing.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say, the heads-up no-limit fields, even when you've played the same... I mean, you're talking about you're only playing a small circle of people. I assume you've played a lot of them, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of hands. I mean, does it not become clear there that, like, one player is clearly better than another? Even, I mean, I would think at that point there would be some decisiveness to it.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever played 100,000 hands with one opponent. I think 30 or 40,000 is probably the most I've played against any individual player.
Yeah, and I guess if that's over the course of a couple of years, someone could think, even if they were losing before, they could win now.
Yeah. And, you know, at some point, very often, it does become clear who's the better player and one guy quits.
Right.
But it takes a while for that to happen. And in the meantime, somebody else may have gone on a heater against some other opponents and decided they want to take a shot at me.
How often does that happen, that somebody outside of the group of like 5 people that you know will play you reliably, how often do you get someone else to sit down and play with you?
I mean, if I'm sitting waiting for action all day every day for a week, I would say probably 3 or 4 random guys will sit down with a min buy-in at 25-50 or play me at 25-50 cap or something like that for a short session. And every once in a while, one of the couple of actual known fish who play a decent amount of heads-up no limit will sit me at 25, 50, or 50, 100, maybe play two tables full stacked for a while.
But, do you do that? I mean, do you sit and wait for action? Or, I mean, do you kind of always have a seat at a table if you're watching a movie? Or, I mean, do you just have a seat open in case somebody decides they want to come sit with you?
No, not always. If I'm not at my computer, or even if I'm at my computer and doing something else, I don't necessarily have tables open. And if I'm playing other games, if I'm playing heads-up sit-and-goes or something, I don't have heads-up cash tables open.
I remember Brian Townsend said something interesting once, and I might get the details wrong, but it was that roughly a third of his bankroll came from random shot takers and hit and runners, so it made it real easy for him not to tilt when he got hit and ran because he knew how much money he'd made from them. Would you say that you've had similar experiences, or do you think that was just a function of when Brian Townsend came up, or what?
Yeah, if he said that in 2008 or so, I would have been inclined to agree with him at the time. I got a lot more action from random names that I hadn't seen before or didn't know very well back then than I do recently.
Gotcha.
What was your entree into poker? Was it through Magic and like the other Magic people who are getting into poker at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I was friends with some guys who were a few years older than me through Magic, and some of them were already doing quite well at poker.
Mm-hmm. So this is how you got the idea that you could go the professional route, or like, that was why it seemed feasible to you to become a professional poker player.
Yeah, I knew professional poker players. When I was in high school, I knew guys who were 22, 23 and had been doing it for a couple of years and supporting themselves.
Yeah, and playing a game for a living seemed pretty cool for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was your aspiration? I mean, were you just thinking like, you know, I just get to the point where I can beat 15, 30 and I'm good to go? Or did you have aspirations of becoming like a traveling pro? How high were you aiming?
I had little conception that there was such a thing as a traveling pro for the first couple of years that I was playing seriously. I thought beat 15-30 limit hold'em was pretty much my goal starting out.
So and you weren't like watching the WSOP on TV or anything?
I did watch the, you know, Moneymaker World Series was my senior year of high school, and I would like play $5 sit and goes with my friends from high school and watch that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was happening around the same time I was getting to know the Magic players who were playing for a living. I mean, I guess I knew that there were WPTs and World Series events and stuff, but the idea of like paying to travel somewhere to buy into a single $10,000 tournament did not seem like how I was going to make a living. And I still had it in my head at this point that poker was going to be sort of a part-time job. I was really serious about academics my first couple years of college. I was studying computer science. I saw myself going to grad school and then maybe becoming a professor. And I thought that if I'm going that route, being able to play poker for 15 hours a week or something for extra money would be really nice.
Yeah, I had a real similar idea.
Yeah.
Your dad's a professor, right?
Yeah, he is.
What does he teach?
English. He writes poetry and teaches English classes, mostly poetry classes, at Syracuse University.
Is he the one who got you into chess?
He played chess with me right from the beginning. It was kind of my own idea.
Just like at 4 years old, you said, I want to play chess?
There was a rainy day at summer camp, and we all had to go inside, and the six-year-olds were playing chess. And I wanted to play chess, and they told me I was too young. I didn't even know how to read. You can't play chess. And I was just really pissed off. I got in the car to go home from summer camp that day and made my dad go straight to the toy store and buy me a chess set and teach me how to play.
Did you ever get to go back and whip the asses of the six-year-olds?
I don't remember, actually. Probably not.
Yeah, I think you would remember if it happened. It probably would have been a pretty satisfying moment for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that did happen.
Do you ever think about getting back into computer science? I mean, computer stuff is one of these great things where you can pick it up pretty much anytime you want, and there are all these free resources available. Do you have any plans in that
direction? Yeah, definitely. I mean, maybe. You know, poker may not be what I want to do forever, and in that next life, picking computer science back up in one way or another might be one of the better ways to make myself marketable or do something useful in some way. And I still mess around with it occasionally. I can, like, just barely put together a functional Java program and occasionally use it to run little bankroll simulations and things like that if I'm curious about some problem, need some help making a decision.
But you have no specific exit plan from poker?
No, not at all.
Do you need to be marketable? I mean, I imagine a fair bit of money saved up. I mean, is there any compulsion just to, like, not work and, you know, retire at 30 years old or something?
I don't think I'm really on pace to be able to just retire at 30. And, I mean, I could retire at 30 and go hang out on a beach in Thailand for the rest of my life. I think I have enough money to do that.
Yeah, that doesn't sound so bad.
No, it doesn't, but I'm married. We might have kids soon. I don't have enough money to retire and raise a family.
Right. Would you like to be able to get to that point? Or, I mean, is poker something you want to keep doing despite the money? Or could you see yourself to a point where you're just like, you know, I have enough money. I'm just going to hang out with my family now.
I could see myself working a lot less if I had a lot more money, but I don't really see myself just quitting poker altogether. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it too much. I'm not really the just relax and hang out all day type. I get antsy if I'm not doing something and working toward a goal and
probably drive your wife crazy.
Competing and drive myself crazy more than anything. I just don't know what to do with myself if I'm not playing poker or studying poker or working on something else.
You still play Magic?
Yeah.
Any other hobbies besides that?
Really, poker and Magic take up a very large percentage of my time. I listen to podcasts, pretty into stand-up comedy, watch some sports. I am very into food, very interested in cooking, but do less of it than I'd like.
Mm-hmm. Andrew just got a wok. What's one thing he should know about cooking with a wok that maybe he doesn't, or that I don't either?
Are you using it on a regular stove, or do you have a wok burner?
I don't have a wok burner, but I do have a gas wrench.
Okay. Well, from what I've never gotten the opportunity to do it, but from what I've read and, you know, seen on Good Eats, you know that show?
I don't.
Oh,
I do. It's amazing.
Into food, yeah, it's the best. It's like Bill Nye the Science Guy has a cooking show.
Yeah,
it's hosted by this guy Alton Brown, who is really geeky and really smart and goes into a lot of detail about the science behind different cooking techniques, like what's happening to the foods on a molecular level and stuff like that.
Yeah, he got into some great arguments about botulism on Twitter the other day. It was fantastic. Did you see that?
No, I missed that. I follow him, but I didn't see that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But anyway, go on.
What he says is that to really use a wok properly, you need a burner that gets much hotter than a typical burner on the stove.
That was my understanding from the research that I did before I started cooking with a wok, and I've settled at a point now where I don't even have my burner turned up all the way when I'm doing it because I was burning stuff. So I don't know if my technique is just really poor, or I don't know what the difference was. But yeah, I came across the same thing in my research, and it hasn't really panned out in terms of how I actually use it. And I mean, the stuff I make tastes good. It's not like I don't feel like it's turning oddly, but I'm definitely not doing it that way.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely just use a wok to cook things, to like saute something in the same way you would in like a French or Italian recipe.
Yeah, I guess that's pretty much what I'm doing.
And yeah, there's definitely nothing wrong with that. But like really traditional wok cooking, which I have no experience with at all, seems like it involves getting the pan really, really hot and moving things around a lot and taking advantage of like the heat differentials from one part of the wok to the other, like moving things up onto the side after you sear them for just a second at the hottest point. And
right.
It looks very complicated. I don't know.
Do you own a sous vide cooker?
I do. It's in storage in Las Vegas, along with every other material possession I love.
So this is part of the hidden cost of Black Friday, huh?
Yes. Yes, that and my bed and my desk chair and my desk and my monitors.
So are you really cranky about where you are now? Like, has moving around been a cool experience in some ways, or are you just pissed off about the whole thing?
Moving around absolutely has been a cool experience. I am in Vancouver at the moment and really like it here. I spend more time in Malta than anywhere else, or at least that's what I have been doing since Black Friday, which is also fantastic. I really like Malta.
Yeah, what is Malta like? I don't really know anything about it.
Well, it's a small island nation. There are three main islands, really two populated islands, like 400,000 people on the bigger one and 100,000 on the smaller one. So very small. It takes like around an hour to drive from one end of the big island to the other. Mm. It's culturally a really interesting place. It's not quite like anywhere else. They have their own language, Maltese, which is a Semitic language, the only Semitic language written in Roman characters. So it's like closest to Arabic, but with pretty heavy influence from Italian and Spanish and a good bit of Greek as well. Huh. So it kind of sounds like people speaking Arabic with an Italian accent, which is exactly as weird as it sounds.
Yeah.
But everyone there also speaks English. It was a British colony until the, I want to say, 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really easy to get around as an English-speaking foreigner. Big tourist destination. Great weather. And in addition to being a tourist destination, there's also a big online gaming industry there. It's one of the places that licenses online gaming sites.
That's it.
And also international banking, tax haven sort of business. So there are a lot of non-locals. It's very accepting of foreigners and easy to get around in.
Mm. So you haven't been compelled to learn much Maltese?
No. People can tell just based on my complexion from a distance that I'm not Maltese. No one ever tries to speak Maltese to me.
Very good. How's your wife like it?
She loves it. It was sort of her idea to go there. After Black Friday, I was playing the World Series, and she went to Malta by herself to check it out and see if it might be somewhere we would like to live. And sort of went there expecting not to like it, but ended up falling in love with it. Had a great time there, saw a bunch of attractive places to live in a nice neighborhood. And so, yeah, she's totally happy with living there.
What was the impetus for Malta? Like, how did that become the first place to look?
It's actually a sort of funny story because really the big draw before visiting it and seeing that it was in fact a really nice place to live was that they had a permanent resident scheme that was very easy to apply for. You basically just had to show that you had enough money to support yourself and you had to buy or rent some property there and spend a certain amount of time there and pay some taxes, but they have a tax treaty with the U.S., so the taxes you pay there are just a write-off from your U.S. taxes. You don't end up paying any extra. But
so you don't deal with limits of like how long you're allowed to be in the country or anything?
Well, that was the plan. And in addition, you get permanent residence there, and it's in the EU, and you can spend as much time as you want anywhere in the EU.
Oh.
So we were thinking, we go, we get permanent residence in Malta. Maybe we really like Malta and we stay there. Maybe we don't, and we go live in Germany.
Yeah, that is a good scheme.
But then, literally the day we arrived, they changed the law to be exactly what it was before, and also you have to give the government €500,000.
it's a small change.
Yeah. Apparently, people were taking advantage of the permanent resident scheme to get free health care. People who had cancer or chronic diseases or whatever, who lived in, a lot of them were from China, a lot of them were from North America, were moving to Malta, becoming permanent residents, and then getting hundreds of thousands of dollars of free health care based on that. They decided to change the law and went pretty far in the other direction from it being very easy to move there to now it's quite difficult. In fact, I do deal with the 90 out of every 180 days in the EU thing and have to travel around a lot for that reason. Like, I sort of can't go back to Europe until March.
Yeah.
So I'm in Vancouver. Last year, I spent this part of the year in Hong Kong for the same reason, which was awesome. I had a great time in Hong Kong, but...
Is there anywhere that's next on the list? Or I mean, Vancouver needs no justification. It's a wonderful place. But after Hong Kong and Vancouver, do you have another place you're looking forward to?
I had been thinking of going to Melbourne, actually, right this time of year this year. But then right at the last minute, found out I was invited to NBC Heads Up. And so that made me stick around North America for like an extra 10 days so that I could play that. Having done that, it seemed a lot less worth the trouble to go to Australia and have to come back like a month later. I decided to skip it and just go to Vancouver instead, since it was a lot easier and a lot less expensive. But spending some time in Melbourne really appeals to me. I've never been there before, and I've heard great things.
Does this feel like a great opportunity to travel the world for you, or is it more of a pain in the ass?
It's a little of each. Definitely some of each. I had always regretted that I didn't do more traveling prior to Black Friday. It was so easy to just hang out at home and play online and maybe every once in a while go as far as like LA for a live tournament or something. But I spent 2 years barely leaving Vegas, barely leaving my apartment in Vegas. So it has been good to, you know, catch up on all the traveling I meant to do. At the same time, this isn't exactly the way I would choose to do it. I spend like half the year living out of suitcases, and even when I'm at home in Malta, it's not quite like being at home. Yeah, I don't have all of the stuff I've gotten used to having.
Well, I think our listeners would be very upset with us if we talked cooking strategy with you, but I didn't ask you anything poker strategy related.
Right?
I know you're, from what I understand, you're pretty into doing like a mathematical analysis of the game, like actually sitting down with the spreadsheet or pen and paper or something and trying to work out the math behind things rather than doing like a, you know, what they would call field play or something. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
For people who are interested in starting down that road, are there situations that you would suggest as being among the more important to analyze first? Like people who are heads up players, what kind of math would you recommend that they work out for themselves?
I mean, a good place to start is just because it's easy to do and sort of a good way to get a feel for how this sort of thing works is start by looking at preflop scenarios where the hand ends either with all of the money going in or somebody folding. Mm-hmm. Work out how things should play out in those scenarios, because it gets so much harder to do analysis when you start dealing with somebody calling and closing the action and then having to estimate the value of that scenario looking forward onto future streets. Whereas something like when the button four bets and I'm looking at, and I have to play five bet or fold. In practice, you call some four bets heads up for sure. But that's a scenario that's really easy sort of get your feet wet looking at that. Mm-hmm. You know, the button risks for much to bluff four bet, which means the big blind you however often to make those bluff four bets unprofitable. Given his three bet range, what hands does he then have to shove? Given he shoves those hands, what can the button stack off? And you can start like finding an equilibrium for the four bet five bet game. Mm-hmm. That's a really relatively basic place to start.
Would you recommend Shannon Ankenman's book?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's fantastic. It's pretty demanding. I don't think you necessarily need to be able to get through that to be able to do productive pen and paper sort of work, figuring things out about poker. But if you can, it definitely teaches you a lot.
Yeah, I thought it was tough, and I was a math major, so that's I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. You think it's pretty tough too.
Oh, absolutely. I've been through it a bunch of times. My copy is falling apart, and I still don't really fully understand a lot of the more difficult stuff in there.
Yeah, mine literally fell apart. I had to take it to the binders and just get a spiral binding, get one of those on it. And I definitely don't understand all of it yet either. So
Well, you guys are definitely making me feel better about that. Do you feel like most of the people that you're playing against have a good understanding of? I mean, because you called that 4-bet, 5-bet game a pretty basic thing to get a grasp of. Do you feel like most of the people that you're playing against have that grasp, or do you still see people making pre-flop mistakes in that way?
I'd say the majority of the people who are doing well at high stakes heads up no limit have a, if not an explicit grasp of how that stuff works, at least an intuitive grasp that causes them not to make big mistakes.
They're approximating it well enough.
Yeah, and I'd say most have some explicit idea of how it works. There are a handful of guys I can think of, and I'm definitely not going to say who I think make giant mistakes with that kind of thing and are still doing pretty well at high stakes.
So the games aren't completely dead, you think, if there are winners at high stakes who are making fairly basic errors?
The games are nowhere near dead. People are still improving rapidly at Heads Up No Limit. There are at least 10 people today who would beat me 2 to 3 years ago, and I thought I was beating everybody 3 years ago.
Wow.
So, and I don't think we're anywhere close to having solved it either. I think the games are going to keep getting tougher.
If you don't mind saying, what kinds of spots do you feel like are the hardest to solve?
You can pass.
like I was saying, anything where you have to call and close the action and guess the value of that scenario going forward over future streets is really tough.
So by definition, like any hand that plays to the river, it will be a more complicated situation than...
Or like judging the value of a flop call, I think is what he's saying, with a lot of money behind.
Yeah, exactly. That judging the value of a flop call, or what hands you can call a pre-flop 3-bet with, things like that are, with the level of analysis anybody is doing right now, are really soft question. It's so dependent on, does the other guy make exploitable turn check folds after betting the flop?
Yeah.
It is, makes the difference between like Jack 5 suited as a call or Jack 8 off as a fold against a 3-bet. Mm-hmm. Like,
do you think that there's some big revolution coming in how we understand those spots, or do you think that people are just going to feel their way around it and learn from experience and make slightly better guesses for a while? Like, do you think there's some way of analyzing those things that we might just be missing that'll strike everyone soon, or no?
Not really. I think that there's some point in the not too distant future where people begin to apply a computer approach like what has succeeded in Limit Hold'em and make some gains that way. But I think that's the potential revolution. Between now and that happening, and that could easily be 10 years away, between now and that happening, I don't think there's going to be a fundamental shift in how people understand that sort of thing.
You're talking about making computers that play Heads Up No Limit well?
Like on the lines of the Limit Hold'em bots that we have now?
Yeah.
Have you played those Limit Hold'em bots?
I've played against the one they have at the Bellagio, which I understand is not as strong as the toughest ones. I haven't played against the toughest ones.
So if you're not seeing that kind of thing coming around in Heads Up No Limit for 10 years, you're not too worried about needing to branch out just yet. But I mean, is that something you think about? Do you worry about the game that's your specialty being one of the more easily solvable?
Yeah, a bit. Definitely.
I mean, I guess so far it's worked in your favor because you're better at solving it than a lot of people are. But
so far, yeah.
Do you have, are you making the attempt to get into games that seem to have more of a future to them?
Yeah, I think this will be my fourth year in a row with a New Year's resolution to learn Pot Limit Omaha.
Me too.
I played a couple hundred hands of Ring PLO today, and I really do want to play a lot of going forward. I think that, I mean, I'm a couple years late to the party at this point for sure, but I think the game is still really soft relative to No Limit right now. Mm-hmm. Which is not to say that I'm better than the people who are winning at high stakes. I'm not. But
the potential is there.
I think that getting better than those people is a pretty achievable goal.
Why do you feel like you're not following up on those resolutions? Just the No Limit games have been too good?
That's part of it. I sort of have a lot of inertia about learning new games because I really hate feeling like I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to get around to learning No Limit because I felt like I knew what I was doing playing Limit Hold'em, and so I just kept doing that even though it did seem like learning element was the right thing to do. And the same thing's going on with PLO now. Like, it's hard for me to put in a lot of hands at 5-10 PLO.
Yeah.
Not even sure I'm beating the game when I could be playing in no limit games that I am pretty sure I'm beating. And it's a lot harder work playing a game. I don't know. I can kind of autopilot my way through no limit games and still feel like I'm doing very well.
I was curious. I meant to ask you about this when you mentioned the PCA, and then it slipped my mind. Most of that money that you won in the PCA was stuck on NetTeller for a while, right?
Yeah, for about 8 months.
How significant was that money to you at the time? I mean, was that like a huge chunk of your bankroll?
Yeah, absolutely. That was ballpark 2/3 of my bankroll at the time.
What was that like?
Did you sell pieces of it?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that many people in the poker world yet at that point. I didn't really feel like I had any trustworthy outs to sell it.
And what it felt like was crappy, I assume?
Yeah, well, I sort of went through a couple different phases with it. For maybe the first 2 weeks, I was sort of in denial about the seriousness of the situation. I was just certain I was going to get my money back. It seemed preposterous that the Department of Justice could just take my money and
who could imagine such a thing?
Yeah, when it was pretty clear I wasn't doing anything illegal. But then some time went by and there was no progress, and I started talking to lawyers, which was a miserable experience. If you ever want to get some insight into the character of a lawyer, try approaching them as a 21-year-old who has close to $1 million locked up somewhere and doesn't really understand what's going on. They were all just trying to convince me that I needed to give them a ton of money right away or all my money was going to disappear. And they couldn't explain why. They couldn't explain what they were going to do about it. They were just trying to scare me. It was really frustrating. I had tried my best to research what was going on in the situation, and so I was going into these conversations with lawyers pretty well informed. They were not well informed. They didn't bother reading up on the situation, and they would just make up arbitrary ways that my money could disappear that didn't seem plausible and say I needed to retain them immediately for $50,000 or my money was going to go away.
Wow.
So, how did you find these people? Like, were they recommended to you? Just go through the phone book?
Yeah, recommended to me.
Yeah, that's really bad.
Yeah.
How did you do it? I mean, did you like call them out on it when they were telling you stuff that you didn't think was true, or how did you stand up to them?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really explicitly say I think you're lying to me right now, but I just sort of calmly explained, like, yeah, the situation was that the money was, according to the Department of Justice, being held as evidence in the case against the NetTeller founders, which is different from seized and different from forfeit. And the lawyers kept talking about the situation as though the money had been seized or forfeited and describing like how I needed them to help me go through the process of making a claim on that money and petitioning to get it that was just not applicable to the scenario. And I would explain to them that it wasn't seized and they would just ignore me and act as though it was.
Did you change your approach after a while? Like after you had a few bad experiences, did you?
Oh, I just gave up. I didn't get a lawyer.
Really?
Yeah. I decided that there was no way I was to show a positive expectation spending money on a lawyer in that situation.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it.
Yeah. It sounded like it was going to cost me 5 to 10% of the money that I had locked up and was not likely to improve my chances of getting it back commensurately.
Good
and were you looking at it as a strictly, I mean, was there any like risk aversion there where you thought, well, maybe it's worth 10%, even if it's not going to increase my chances by more than 1 or 2%, or were you just really looking at it as an EV calculation?
Pretty much just looking at it as an EV calculation. You know, it was a lot of my money at the time, but I was also extremely confident in my ability to make more money at the time, perhaps even more confident than I should have been. But I was crushing the games online at that point, and it felt like I would fairly easily recover from the situation, even if I didn't get that money back. And it didn't seem like a good idea to throw too much money at the situation if it, I didn't think it was going to work out.
I think I'd have trouble respecting myself if I knew that I had just handed over like $70,000 to some asshole like that.
Yeah, that too. That too, for sure.
How long did it take before you did get it back?
About 8 months. I got back in late July or early August. I knew I was going to get it back considerably sooner than that. Mm. There was really only a couple of months where it was seriously in limbo. Somebody with some inside information on the whole process took me aside at a poker tournament and told me, don't sell it, you're fine.
That's nice.
Wow. What yeah. I mean, I know you can't say much, but a lot of people claim to have inside knowledge of a lot of things in the poker world. Was it a clear decision to believe this person?
Yeah, I mean, the situation that came up was I was at a table and one pretty well-known, established, older poker player was trying to buy a debt from me. And we were sort of negotiating over the table, talking about it. He was trying to get it at a really low price, and it didn't seem like a good idea to me. Mm-hmm. And then on the next break, another very established poker player took me aside and said, I personally know a bunch of people involved in this, and I can tell you with absolute certainty you're getting your money back. Don't sell it at a discount to this dude.
So I take it you've bought him a beer since then?
Yeah.
Or a brewery. Well, thanks for that, Ike. Was there anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten around to?
Nothing in particular, no.
Or plug. Plug anything you want.
Promote, sell.
Follow me on Twitter, @IkePoker. Play on PokerStars.
Yeah, if you're going to take a shot.
We didn't even talk about that, did we?
Yeah, if you're going to take a shot, take the shot against Ike, okay?
So, yeah, it's extra fun. You see a picture of me while you're playing against me. It's really nice.
Yeah, it's the best thing you can do. It's got to be the most fun way to take a $5,000 or $10,000 shot at poker. So
definitely.
All right, thanks very much, Ike. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, happy.
Yeah, that's cool. Have a good night.
Yeah, you too.
I was really happy with how this interview went. I think that it went really well. I think we talked about a lot of interesting things. I'm sure that we went places that most other interviews with Ike have not gone, and hopefully it was interesting to him for that reason. Because especially now with him having joined Team Online, I think he's kind of making the rounds or doing a lot more interviews. And I know he's done a lot of interviews over the course of his career, so hopefully this was something a little different for him and for fans of his.
Yeah, I hope so too. And it makes it all the more remarkable that he was so thoughtful and generous with his attention. You know, he definitely did not mail it in. He really he really gave us a lot of thought, and I'm grateful to him for that.
Yeah, and the one thing I was going to say on that point is that I am glad that this was not one of our first interviews. You know, I think that this interview would not have gone so well if it were, you know, one of our first five episodes. I think being more comfortable interviewing people contributed a lot to our being able to ask better questions or keep the conversation flowing a little bit. Because as you said, he was it was very different from the interview we did for the previous episode with Ian Hall, which, you know, understandably, I think that being charismatic and being talkative is one of the most important characteristics that a teacher can have, or to be a good teacher. I think that that's really important. And when I started doing some teaching, it was not a skill that I had. And so part of the reason that I can, you know, hopefully be a decent podcast host these days has to do with kind of forcing myself to get a little bit more extroverted and charismatic in order to be effective as a teacher. And so, you know, with Ryan, it's just sort of, he comes on, we almost didn't have to ask questions. Like, he just came in ready to talk. And all we were doing was like steering a little bit. And I think Ike was more up for talking about anything, but it was on us to, you know, decide what that needed to be or to prompt him to do it. Yeah, certainly. I appreciate that willingness on his part to, you know, kind of say nothing's off bounds. I'll talk about whatever you guys want, but I think it did require a little more skill on our part than I at least would have been able to bring to the table in our first couple of episodes.
Absolutely, and I found it so awesome and tantalizing, this glimpse into the cutting edge of the theory of Hold'em, right? Where he said, you know, we figured a lot of things out, and one thing that we don't have yet is a good account of when you should call bets with a lot of money behind, just because it's very hard to figure out the equity that you have going forward. So it's fun to hear about where the sort of current frontier is.
Yeah, and you know, that's one thing that's so interesting about him, is that he's, I think, a lot more self-aware of how he's getting better at poker, or how he'll continue to get better at poker, and where the game is evolving. And it seems like, not that I've had a lot of opportunities to pick the brains of other top players, but it seems like, compare him to, say, a Tom Dwan, where it seems like, I don't really imagine Tom sitting down with a spreadsheet and trying to like work out mathematically the correct approach to certain situations. I don't know that he doesn't do those things, but I don't see him doing it in exactly the same way that Ike is doing it. You disagree with that?
I think there's a pretty good chance that he knows more of that spreadsheet knowledge, if you want to call it that, than you're giving him credit for. But I do think that he might not be going about it in as systematic a way.
Yeah, maybe that's what, like, it just seems like Isaac is so theoretically driven, I guess, and that's one reason why I'm drawn to him in terms of like a poker inspiration, or a person, like a role model, maybe.
Yeah.
More so than I don't really identify with Tom in the same way. Not that I don't like respect him as a player or anything, but I think that if I were in a position that I was trying to hire one of the like top players in the world to be a coach, I think that Ike's, from what I've seen, Ike's approach to thinking about the game is probably more in keeping with my own than a lot of other top players is. Or I should say, mine is more in keeping with his.
Yeah, that's probably right. That's probably right. And I think a lot of players have just gotten where they are by doing things in a much more piecemeal way, by just talking about a ton of hands and then learning about common spots that they know are common just because they've actually seen them a lot.
And yeah, that's what I meant to be getting at, really.
Yeah. And then, of course, they go back and they work out the math for some of those spots. But, I don't think that there are as many people who have done the kind of broad systematic work who have as robust an understanding of the theory of the whole game as Ike does, probably. So kudos to him for that. And that's probably no accident that he's at the very top. So
I'm glad we came back to the PayPal thing. I don't know, or the NetTeller thing. Like, I almost didn't. I was like, whatever, it's almost over. But I wanted to ask him about it. I think that turned out pretty interesting.
Yeah, it was fucking awesome.
And the other thing that I thought was funny is you and I were talking before we had Ike on the show, and not that you're really going to turn down a chance to interview someone like Ike, but I sort of expressed the concern that we had a lot of like PokerStars affiliated people, and especially PokerStars Team Online people coming on the show already, and we have a few people sort of from that same world that we're looking at having on in the near future. And a big part of the reason for that is that those are people that we have connections to, like with my having formerly been on Team Online myself, I've had some opportunities to meet those people, and it's a little easier for me to ask them to come on the show. But I was wondering if we shouldn't be concerned about having just being perceived as like a mouthpiece for PokerStars, or that we're just too oriented towards PokerStars, especially since they're such a behemoth now in the online world with their having acquired Full Tilt Poker. And by the time we got to the end of that interview with Ike, when you asked him if there was anything he wanted to plug, and he mentioned PokerStars, I had like forgotten entirely about his connection to PokerStars, which was your prediction. You were saying, like, I mean, even though he's on Team Online, it's not like he's going to be shilling for PokerStars, or anyone is really going to think of him as like a PokerStars person first and foremost. He's just an interesting and very talented poker player who happens to be on Team Online now, but he certainly did not come here with an agenda of trying to jam PokerStars into the answer of every question that he gave.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I still find him wearing a patch a bit incongruous, the same way that I find Phil Ivey wearing a patch sort of incongruous, though in a very different way. I just think of both of those.
Phil Ivey tweeting.
Yeah, that's also really weird.
which I lay pretty good money is not Phil Ivey tweeting. But
he usually says whether it is or it isn't. Like the ones that are actually him, and usually with --PI.
I see.
Yeah. No, it's usually not him. But, you know, in very different ways, I think of both Ike and Phil Ivey as kind of just clouds of purified thought that that don't like and that like where like the bodily manifestation is somehow secondary, and things like wearing patches and promoting things are just not part of what they do. But
you know, I think it's kind of funny that there's this expectation that, because I mean, people have been kind of upset, or not even upset, but just kind of like making jokes or something about the fact that it's often clearly not Phil Ivey on the Phil Ivey account doing his tweets, which I don't think there's really any other. Like, if you follow Barack Obama on Twitter, Barack Obama is obviously not the one writing those tweets.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for a lot of public figures. But it doesn't seem to be true in the poker world. I mean, I think Phil Ivey is kind of the rare exception there. Even Doyle Brunson, who seems like one of the least likely people in the poker world to be on Twitter, does seem, you know, I believe that it's actually Doyle on there most writing those tweets, and that seems to be the case. So it is interesting, and I think that the poker players, even the most prominent ones, do seem to be doing their own Twitter work, which is not even the expectation in many other public spheres, not just politics, but a lot of other ones, which I feel like that's kind of the point. That was supposed to be the point of Twitter originally, or the reason why you would follow those people on Twitter, as opposed to like read a press release or something, is that you're supposed to be getting something direct from the directly from the person that's not been mediated by PR people. And now, of course, it's turned into just another PR outlet for a lot of people, but I think it's good that poker hasn't generally gone that direction, and I guess that's why some people do kind of take umbrage with the Phil Ivey account, because it's moving in a direction that I'd rather not see Twitter go in the poker world.
Yeah, that's right. But that said, I think a lot of people actually do their own tweeting. I mean, I think Steve Martin and Mark Maron and any number of baseball players that I follow, maybe not all baseball players, but a lot of them still do their own tweeting, so hooray for that. But anyhow, good show. Nice work. We'll see everybody next week.
Thanks again to Isaac.